get them out rapidly, or again, we're not going to have a country.
Since Trump took office for his second term, we've seen a lot of this.
President Trump's massive immigration crackdown.
ICE agents are arresting nearly 800 people every day.
This nation is under distress.
Clashes over President Trump's ICE raids.
Rallies across the country opposing President Trump's agenda on the day of the president's military parade.
But amid the arrests and deportations, there's this one weird story.
Nearly 60 white South Africans were admitted into the United States. It's part of President Donald Trump's resettlement program for white Afrikaners.
Farmers are being killed. They happen to be white, but whether they're white or black makes no difference to me. It's a genocide that's taking place that you people don't want to write about.
Donald Trump's administration is aiming to bring the first group of white South Africans to the United States via its refugee program as soon as next week.
What are we doing? Earlier this year, Trump brought in 59 white South Africans on priority one refugee status, just a few months after basically blocking new refugees from coming into the US entirely. It's almost certainly got to do with Elon, who might, maybe, perhaps, also be the rogue ex-employee who made 3 a.m. changes to Grok AI so it'd be obsessed with white genocide. We don't know for sure, I guess. But if we're not 100% about that little detail, we do know what the bigger picture is here. Trump, Elon, and the Afrikaners they're bringing in are taking advantage of a huge flaw with how liberalism handles justice. A flaw that lets white supremacists call themselves victims and somehow gets people to listen. A flaw that also, conveniently, also makes it either too late or too soon for things like reparations. We're talking about historical justice today. Howdy friends, JT from the future here. I just wanted to take a quick second to do a shameless plug for Means TV, both because it's awesome and because being a dirty communist on YouTube is looking like more and more of a losing proposition. If you're not familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos to original series like Means Morning News to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. I've been working behind the scenes to help turn Means into a place that's both worthwhile for viewers as well as offering financial security for socialist creators in an increasingly reactionary political landscape. Every creator on the platform has a unique link that when anyone signs up using that link, that creator directly benefits from the subscription. I have mine in the description below, but if you really appreciate another creator's work, make sure to use their link instead. All of us at Means are trying really hard to build an alternative media ecosystem that is ideologically dedicated to sharing left-wing perspectives. With Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and fans right on the platform. As a little thank you for watching our channel, if you sign up with our link, or another creator's if you prefer, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get the whole year 20% off. A full year of Means TV will run you less than $90, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using a creator's link is directly contributing to the financial stability of that channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Means TV is entirely grassroots funded, and it always will be. So if you'd like to help support our work, consider signing up for Means TV using the link below. It really does help the team here at Second Thought and dozens of principled socialist creators across the platform. Thanks for your support. All right, back to the video. On the one hand, the political goal of this refugee thing is obvious. It's white supremacy. After making immigration near impossible for black and brown people, cutting off foreign aid, and generally making life more dangerous for millions of people in the global south, that a handful of completely fine white people are the only ones getting help is sending a clear message. It's a smokescreen giving the Trump administration license to do what it values most, making it seem like only white people can integrate here so that discrimination and violence against everybody else seems justified. Callie Holloway in The Nation put it perfectly. This is an administration putting white grievance above black suffering. Because, let's be clear, white South Africans are not a persecuted group. For being only 7% of the population, whites occupy more than 62% of corporate leadership positions. 2 in every 3 black South Africans are impoverished, while just 1% of white South Africans are. Whites still own 75% of the land. And Trump and Elon's claims that white farmers are being uniquely targeted and killed or having their land taken from them is just untrue. White genocide is simply, obviously, not real. It's not true here, it's not true there. There is no apartheid version 2. South Africa is still a country where white people just have it better. So why is that apartheid V2 rhetoric being used here? Why would anybody think those still benefiting from racial privilege are victims? I think that to understand this, we should talk about the real apartheid.
As the late Prime Minister, Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, put it, we want to keep South Africa white. Keeping it white can mean only one thing, namely, white domination. Not leadership, not guidance, but control, supremacy.
You probably know most of this already, but apartheid was the system of white minority rule in South Africa that lasted from 1948 to 1994, though segregation and white supremacy were around for a lot longer. Under apartheid, that segregation was further codified, enforced, and made more extreme. Black South Africans were physically kept apart from whites, segregated into what were called Bantustans, dependent states that excluded black people from South African citizenship. Non-whites were forced out of their homes, their land, and politics entirely. The choice for most was either living in these neglected reservations or staying in the white areas, most often illegally and facing severe discrimination. Interracial sex and marriage were forbidden. Non-white South Africans were forced to work for white South Africans for low pay. And everyone who publicly opposed this system was either killed, as 21,000 people were, or disappeared and detained without trial, as over 80,000 people were. There's a lot more awful stuff to apartheid than we can get to right now. But it's important that you have some idea of what happened to know that to get past all this and to get to justice, South Africa did something called truth and reconciliation. When you go from a deeply discriminatory society, full of brutal supremacist violence, you do have to ask yourself, how can we ever move forward? For liberals, the answer was the TRC.
Welcome to the first special report on the Truth Commission. The Commission's first hearings were held here in the East London Town Hall, and it's been a week of raw emotion.
To move beyond apartheid, the goal of the TRC was to establish a culture of human rights in South Africa. Like in Chile and Argentina before, liberals believed that to get past the evil those societies went through, there needed to be a clear cultural acknowledgement that evil would be firmly left behind. And getting to a consensus that the past was evil begins by agreeing that the evil is past. They did that through public investigations and trials, meant to reveal the extent of violence under apartheid and prosecute some of its most prominent figures. Importantly, the goal was to prosecute as few people as absolutely necessary. Only the amount that would make the past system universally immoral and give space for victims to lay their grievances bare, while showing that the new society was different. These trials would not be a purge or a thorough investigation of guilt. They were there to create a culture of human rights and the rule of law. If some people escaped judgment, that was fine, as long as they now accepted that the rules had changed. In that way, the TRC built a vision of justice that was almost entirely forward-looking, a vision of justice in which everyone, except only the most vile racists, could agree that apartheid was evil. But importantly, a vision of justice that did not ask the white beneficiaries of apartheid to give up anything material. They were just asked to have a little compassion. The TRC asked of white South Africans, and everyone else today, to imagine themselves as little more than well-intentioned witnesses to evil. People who, hypothetically, would have done something if they could have, regardless of if they actually did. By simply acknowledging evil, it's basically as if they had. In this way, the TRC did 2 important things for liberal justice. It relieved white anxiety, and it reduced the victims of apartheid suffering in the present to basically just trauma. Not a continued suffering under compounding inequality, just trauma that is effectively healed when all these compassionate, would-be justice warriors feel bad. without them ever needing to agree to restitution. Meanwhile, post-apartheid South African society could continue to have the same hierarchy as before. This is the important bit about the way that justice in South Africa took place. Thanks to events like the TRC, those who benefited from apartheid could think of themselves as completely distinct from the process of its perpetration. And on the other side, they could think of the victims of apartheid as either completely innocent and unthreatening, those who would agree to the blank slate reset, or dangerous, those who would ask for more than just thoughts and prayers. And that second camp could be permanently imagined as a lingering threat. They could be demonized. They don't fit into the neat model of the TRC. They don't fit into the new culture of human rights and legal order. They were asking for too much. They were a threat. And in that way, white beneficiaries could imagine themselves as future victims. They could equate the suffering of innocent victims of apartheid, those they no longer feared, with their own imagined future suffering at the hands of those who didn't accept that the TRC had definitively settled the question of what to do about injustice. After all, why should there be a revolution if all these beneficiaries agreed that what happened was bad and that the perpetrators, those who actually did apartheid, had already been dealt with? Justice was served, even if things didn't look all that different. Knowing that they'd never have to lose anything, they could calmly call out the past and permanently block any restitution by weaponizing white fears. The narrative you're left with is that redistribution in 1994 would have just been too soon. It could have jeopardized the peace process. And today, of course, it's too late. Why would we make people who had nothing to do with apartheid pay? It's not a very different argument from what we hear in the US. Bringing up slavery is dredging up the past. It's too late for reparations. Segregation's been over for generations. All that does is divide us. How do we know whose ancestors were slaves and whose ancestors were slaveholders? Have you heard about the Irish? They were slaves too, don't you know?
Now, to be clear, as if it's necessary, slavery is evil. But let's be honest, up until 150 years ago, when a group of brave Americans fought and died to finally put an end to it, slavery was the rule rather than the exception around the world, and had been for thousands of years, sadly.
This rhetoric is everywhere when we talk about historical injustice. The evil is in the past. It bears on the present, sure, but because we're not responsible ourselves, the best we can do is try to have fair rules from now on. This way of thinking about justice is flawed, but we should start by acknowledging that it's coming from an accurate insight. The history of every society is one of horrible injustice. Violence, exploitation, discrimination, and suffering are staples of the historical canon, and there isn't one single objective point where things were fair that we can try to rewind to. Every point in history is following and followed by injustice. It's also true that no one in the present has agency over the evils that their ancestors either enacted or suffered from. But just because those things are true doesn't mean we should limit justice to this idea that the worst thing about the past is that it causes trauma in the present, and that white guilt, the rule of law, and human rights are the best we can offer. Just because we can't have an arbitrary baseline to which we can return doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive for more than thoughts and prayers. The answer to historical injustice isn't pretending that we're all on level footing already. The answer is material equality. If most inequality today is a result of history, and most of history was bad, equality is a solution for all the injustices we inherit. This is particularly necessary because of how capitalism works. The capitalist model of finance and growth rewards those who start out with more, regardless of why they do. That anyone inherits privilege and wealth under capitalism means that we're constantly on track to bigger and bigger gaps between the rich and the poor based on the worst atrocities people before us have committed. Evil is not past. It's constantly accumulating and growing. It's the very nature of the present. And many liberals might agree. Of course, inequality is unjust, but you know what they think is worse? That revolutionaries may try to do anything about it beyond pretending good intentions will fix everything. Instead of only dealing with justice at the level of trauma, revolutionary justice implicates beneficiaries directly in the process of restitution. It doesn't say beneficiaries and perpetrators are the same, but it does demand that those who just got lucky should not be allowed to continue to make gains and widen the gap on the back of that historical injustice without material concessions. If you don't deserve to have things taken away from you because you personally didn't do anything wrong, you don't deserve to use it for personal gain either. Meaning, if things just worked out for you, your family set you up, you were born into high status, fine, it's not your fault, that's great. The very minimum of justice, though, is that there are conditions on what happens now. Your wealth cannot grow at the expense of others. You can absolutely still make money, but only if we close that gap in the process. You invest some of your money well, it'll be taxed and used for universal programs. You have a ton of land, you're not getting more than you can use. You're on Wall Street and you gambled too hard? We'll prevent the crash if and only if it'll mean everyone is better off afterwards. We're not doing austerity. The very rich will pay something to everyone else for things to return to normal. If we can never pinpoint the exact amount of historical suffering that everyone is a victim of, but we do know that it's responsible for so much being awful, there is a solution to that that doesn't just ask us to pretend that the heir to an emerald mine can just get whatever he wants. This reasonable path to justice is a difficult pill to swallow for liberals, who would much prefer that those who want justice are either completely pacified and content with thoughts, prayers, and white guilt, or bloodthirsty guerrillas who can't tell the difference between perpetrators and beneficiaries. In the liberal narrative, those who want justice are either useless or terrifying. And as a result, all those who benefit through no fault of their own can stall equality forever by playing on the fear that justice could, maybe, we don't know, be just as bad as what it's trying to rectify. Apartheid version 2. But those are not the only options. Privilege is not something that people own. It's a relative status. And that relative status is not a right that anyone is entitled to. If you have wealth held in assets that are only valuable so long as everyone keeps going along with capitalism and doesn't make too much of a fuss, there is a cost to that inequality. Students could always stop paying their loans back. Mortgage payments can be paused. Boycotts can last pretty much forever. If the whole process of transitional justice was based on doing the least possible to get political stability, what if political stability suddenly depended on much more than admissions of guilt? What if it actually depended on real, material equality? So much history led us to where we are today. Why should only a few keep the gains of injustice?